Welcome to the Apprenticeship.io podcast, where we gather the courageous leaders the tech industry needs to talk about education equity, job hunts, hiring in tech, and you guessed it, apprenticeships. Whether you're considering a career switch to tech, currently studying, or working and leading in tech, we hope to show you stories, ideas, and tactics to inspire you and equip you to make the tech industry and our future together a more equitable place for all of us. Let's get to know today's guest.
Today's guest is Meredith Jones. Meredith became a senior software engineer at LinkedIn in September 2020 during the COVID-19 pandemic. Meredith was an apprentice in the first cohort of LinkedIn Reach. Before becoming a software engineer, Meredith was a clinical dietitian for 7 years. She studied dietetics at Brigham Young. Meredith loves biking, the audio app Clubhouse, and Japanese culture. This episode was recorded in March 2021 and talks about travel and culture in Asia. We want to take this opportunity to stand in solidarity with our Asian brothers and sisters around the world against hate. We stand against anti-Asian and anti-Muslim hate, racism, and xenophobia, both at home in America and abroad. We are so sorry for what is happening and want to remind everyone to stay open-minded, think critically, and care for each other during these tough times. If you're unfamiliar with the rise in hate crimes against Asians in the United States and the rise in hate crimes against Muslims in India, Myanmar, and China, this is your prompt and opportunity to learn more. We hope you enjoy this episode. So welcome to the show, Meredith. I'm so happy to have you back.
Thank you. It's been so long.
Yeah, 2 years. Also, wild 2 years. What were some of the highs and lows?
Oh boy, it's so hard to think about anything before the pandemic because that just consumed my and everybody's lives. So let's just count that as the low. It also served as a good opportunity to reflect in my life on what's important, pick up some new hobbies, learn some new skills, think about habits. As far as work goes in the past couple years, I've just continued to learn so much and to grow in my career. I'm really happy with where it's going and where it's been in the past 2 years. So I'd say that a big highlight has just been continuing to grow at work.
That's awesome. The last time we chatted, just for context, Dev Bootcamp had shut down like a few months before. You were well into your software engineer role, but I think it was like April-ish of 2017, if that helps. It feels like the last year has been a century.
Yeah. Before that, it's just like, what even happened? I don't know. Yeah. A couple of things that happened pre-pandemic that were definite highlights outside of work was my husband and I got to travel, most notably, he's from Singapore. So we went to Southeast Asia. We were able to go to Singapore, Japan, and Taiwan. Those are all such special and magical places. That was one of the big highlights back in the days when we could travel. Just getting out and seeing the world a little bit has been really cool for me.
That's amazing. I actually did a work study visa in Singapore. It's super gorgeous. What were some of your favorite parts of Singapore?
Oh man, how do I choose? Let's see. The food is amazing. Singapore is renowned for its incredible culinary diversity and the quality. This is really random, but I really like their swimming pools. They have a ton of community lap pools and just being able to swim. It's hot there, and so going swimming is an awesome exercise to do. I was also lucky to LinkedIn has an office. I was able to work out of that office for a week and experience working life in another country, which was cool. There was a lot to love about Singapore for sure.
Remember offices?
Right? Back in the day when we went into work. Oh my goodness.
That's amazing. I love the street food in Singapore, especially. Yes. Like, I forget what the little markets are called, but
the hawker centers.
Hawker centers. Yes.
Oh yeah. Good stuff.
So good. So good. I ate my way through Singapore, so much chicken and rice every day.
Oh, that's the only way to do it.
So good. And then you said you went to some other spots. Where else did you go?
We went to Taiwan on that trip, and it was so beautiful. We got to do a little bit of hiking. We weren't there for very long, but again, the street food. Anyone who listens to this podcast will be like, all this person does is eat. But man, the food there is great. The milk tea there was great. The people were so warm and friendly. It was an amazing place to be.
Milk tea and boba, I have forgotten. Taiwan did fantastic with the pandemic. I've had friends talking about going to move there just so that they can, you know, resume life as normal.
Yeah. From what I understand, they had some experience with health crises in the past, and so they were very well prepared when it comes to responding to this. So mad props to them.
And if I am following the timeline correctly, you got promoted recently in pandemic times.
Let's see, it was last September. So that was during pandemic. So at LinkedIn, they have this thing called a promo packet. And I'm not sure how it works in the rest of the industry, but you basically put together a document of proof that you should be promoted, for lack of a better term. It's just things that you've done. It goes in front of the people who evaluate it, and they give you like a yes, no, or work on this and that, and then maybe come back next time. I was lucky to have my document accepted. So they decided to promote me. It's so funny because it's one of those things that I never thought would happen, coming in as a apprentice and just a career switcher. You think maybe one day, but like probably not. Just the self-doubt gets in the way. My boss was just amazing about being like, no, like this is happening. Let's put together the evidence. Let's work on the document. I'm grateful for the encouragement and the leadership of my manager in supporting me in this. If it were left up to me, I would just be like, no, I don't think I deserve it. It was a very rewarding process.
Yeah, it seems like another one of those instances where having a great manager is just so important in everything. Were you being managed over the 3 years towards promo? Was there context for you of how long the process would take and what the steps or what you would need to demonstrate would be? Or was it something that got brought up quickly?
Yeah, so it does happen the whole time. Along the way, we talk about the steps that are needed for promo. Just for a little bit more context, at LinkedIn, we have three sort of buckets where you want to make sure that you are meeting the requirements. They are leadership, execution, and craftsmanship. In each of these buckets, there's criteria. It's almost like a checklist. Do you demonstrate this aspect of leadership? Do you mentor people? Do you help bring top talent to LinkedIn? Do you lead projects? Things like that. And then execution is more focused on what work did you actually do? And then craftsmanship is focused on how did you do that work and how did you improve the whole ecosystem? We work on all those buckets from day one. Even as an apprentice, you're held to criteria to finish the apprenticeship. And then same three buckets, but slightly different criteria. And then as you move up, basically the buckets increase in scope. You're expected to have more influence, do bigger projects, think outside your team. By the time the promo came, we were set up for success because we were thinking about it the whole time.
It sounds like it's pretty clear and something that you're documenting as you go. If I put on my career coach hat, this is why you have to pay attention not only to doing the things that are important for your job, but recognizing yourself and documenting the things that you did so that you can show them off on your resume or show them off on your promo pack.
I just have to say, it is so much easier to document if you have a running list. If you try to go back and be like, okay, what did I do? That is so hard. Any way you can have some sort of documentation, a list of what you've done from day to day or from month to month or quarter to quarter, that will help you so much in not only proving to the company, but also proving to yourself, look, all these things I did, I deserve this.
I feel like that part must be hard, still dealing with imposter syndrome. Is this one of your goals that you wanted to reach when you came in as an apprentice? Or is this something that you are like pleased by, but it's not like something that you set out to do?
Yeah, it was definitely a goal, but it was like you said, with imposter syndrome, it's a delicate balance because you want to be realistic. And if you're struggling with imposter syndrome, it's just, should this even be a goal type thing? Do I even deserve this? Like, at what point are they going to find out that I have no idea what I'm doing? But eventually, when I became a little bit more comfortable in my role and in my skin, it was a lot more solid of a goal. It wasn't like a thing that hopefully will happen one day. It was a thing that, yeah, let's try to make it happen this year.
You've been at LinkedIn now for going on over 3.
Almost 4, yeah.
Almost 4 as well. So I'm sure you've seen potentially different managers, different teammates. You probably hold down a decent amount of institutional knowledge. How has your role shifted over time as you've stayed at the organization longer?
That's a good question. I have a very strange an unusual experience of having the same manager the whole time that I've been at LinkedIn. That's because he's a good manager, so I try to stick with him. But as far as my role changing throughout LinkedIn, I think more and more I've tried to take on leadership type opportunities, like lead larger projects, think about what's important to me personally, and how that fits in with my team and with LinkedIn's vision, and try to match the two so that I can have an initiative or have a project that I'm both passionate about and will benefit LinkedIn. As a software engineer, as an apprentice, you're doing the smaller tasks or the smaller projects. And as you grow in your role, you're also growing in your scope. Instead of having a project or a task handed to you, you start to think about, like, how can I personally contribute to the roadmap in a meaningful way? Or how can I contribute to the company in a meaningful way? One of the things that I started, let's see, it was last year, it was after I got promoted, I started getting involved more with the Women in Tech program at LinkedIn in a couple different ways. The first is leading one of the tracks in charge of helping women within the organization grow personally and professionally. We do things like talk, have forum about career goals or mentorship and help other people grow. Another role that I took on recently was starting to think more about how can we encourage young women, like in high school and middle school, to know about tech, that this is something that they can do. I'm working with a team at LinkedIn to try to figure out how to outreach. Long story short is that these things are things that I'm passionate about. And so I've just found ways to incorporate them into my job.
It sounds like you're able to expand the horizon of what you can see.
Yeah.
And just working on immediately what's handed to you. And I empathize with this a lot, but like stressing out a whole lot about not knowing just the thing that's in front of you. It's, you feel a bit more confident that the stuff that you will get, you'll be able to work on. And then you pick your head up and you're like, what's on the horizon that I can anticipate?
Exactly. So I've heard it referred to as like zooming out, or like a bird's eye view. You start to see the big picture and you think about, like, where do I fit in this big picture and how can I contribute to it, instead of just focusing on the next, like putting one foot in front of the other. And it's really rewarding to have that vision and to have that potential for impact. That's one of the things that growing in a software engineering role is really rewarding. And it's interesting how going into engineering, I thought you'd be coding most of the time. But as it turns out, the more you grow in your role, the more you are working with people and with product and with overall vision. It's so much more than just engineering. It's leadership and it's impact.
It sounds like your interests and passions really align well with the LinkedIn product. So you get to contribute in ways that's like dynamic and across different functions.
Yeah, for sure. I think especially with LinkedIn Learning, it's really important to me to be able to build a tool that will help people get to where they would like to be with their skills and make the path to those skills available to anyone who's willing to put in the time. It's a really neat product to be a part of, because the future of learning is developing skills and finding the right skills for what you want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. We can give some background context for folks who aren't familiar, who are new to the tech industry. There used to be this site called lynda.com. That was a course website. It was very popular, that LinkedIn acquired and has been building out and productizing the LinkedIn Learning. My understanding is a lot of the original content came from Lynda, but I assume now it's a lot of newer courses. I personally see a lot of new courses all the time and they seem really exciting. I assume learning also ties in with some of the certifications and endorsements and things that are on LinkedIn profiles. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the features that you've worked on and what are the goals? You touched on democratizing access to skills and things like that, but curious if you can get into the user journey. What are some of the things you're trying to do with the features you're building?
One of the big initiatives that my team is working on is this persona called the curator. And that is a role that basically allows users to upload their own custom content, documents, videos, or make learning paths, which is a series of content for people to learn from. When we think about the skills that we want to acquire, there's skills that are technical and across industry the same, and then there's skills that you want to learn from your peers. It's knowledge that's specific to the company and maybe eventually knowledge that's not specific to the company. Right now, it's like in company sharing of knowledge. We're giving the tools to create content and to curate content to more people so that we can establish a broader learning base for learners so that learners can learn from their peers and gain skills from subject matter experts around the company. So that's been really exciting because the Lynda videos and the new LinkedIn.com videos are incredible. They're so good and they're so professionally done. There's definitely some skills that you learn within your company. And if you're at a company for a long time and if you have knowledge that maybe isn't documented in other places, the ability to add that knowledge to this knowledge base, I feel is really powerful. That's what we've been working on. I think the team is really excited about the direction that we're going with that.
Yeah, I think anyone who's been dropped into like a dumpster fire onboarding process probably really understands the value of employees and teammates curating knowledge and videos around how to do things. Sounds like almost making playlists similar to how you'd make them like on Spotify, but instead for your colleagues of here's how I do my job or here's how we run this process at our company.
Yeah, exactly. One example of how I use it on my team is we have this group of UI engineers in learning and we meet. And if we talk about things that we feel are going to be helpful for people down the road, we'll record the session. And then we put the session in a playlist. Someone coming into our team specifically will be able to know a catalog of what we've talked about in the past. It's definitely been helpful in a number of ways so far.
That's awesome. And then I imagine years back, you were working on different features. What were some of the things you worked on in the past?
We've worked on a lot of things that help make content more discoverable, more relevant. For example, one of the things I worked on in the past is the ability to add a custom tag to your custom content. So that's make things more discoverable. We've worked on total refreshes of really old looking pages. So while that's not necessarily a big like behavior change drive, having a visual refresh can be just as important because you're keeping up with the other industries and their UIs. What else have we worked on? We only used to have video uploads and we added document uploads and various settings to help users who are uploading content have an easier time doing so. Whether that's being able to make your content discoverable, being able to label your content with the name that you'd like to label it or the author, being able to upload custom like thumbnail images, things like that. So everything to make uploading content and curating content easier, prettier, more intuitive. It's pretty much the charter of our team.
I'm envisioning this tagging feature that you worked on as being super accessible conceptually to other non-traditional engineers who are more junior. And I'm wondering, for the apprentice level or maybe someone who's still in school, who's imagining their coding process, like maybe if they're doing an Airbnb clone for the first time and they have a feature that tags whatever it is that someone may be trying to rent, we could say a house if we're doing an Airbnb clone. If they're adding a tag, they're probably closing their own pull request potentially. They're really not interacting with a lot of conflicts. How does it look for you at LinkedIn getting a feature rolled out at, you know, a huge organization that might differ from what someone who's like building a CRUD app for the first time might experience? Can you give us a sense of what it might look like when you roll out something that you've built?
Yeah, of course. After we get the product requirements from our PM and the designs from our designer, we work with our backend partners to make sure that what we're getting what we expect from them and we're giving them what they expect. So the feature, let's say, is dev complete. And that's after having your code reviewed to get it submitted and deployed to prod, which is the process where you take it from, I guess, the experimental or the staging environment to the production environment where other people can see it. If we start there, then before we ramp it, so basically in the beginning, we only show a new feature to test accounts. And we use this platform to hide, like basically we do just if checks to only show that the feature based on a key that we add in. And so at first, it's only ramped to test accounts. And on those test accounts, we do something called a bug bash. In bug bashes, we get together as a team and we try to find all the ways we can break the feature. We get a bunch of tickets of bugs and we take those tickets and we triage them. We say, okay, this one is serious. We need to do this one right away. This one is less serious. Got to do this before we ramp to everybody, but maybe it's okay to ramp to a few more people before we fix it. Basically, we prioritize the bugs. Then we start fixing the bugs. Once the most critical bugs are fixed, we start ramping to more people. In my team, what that looks like is we ramp to our company first. Basically, everyone in LinkedIn can see the new feature. And then we wait a week or so and fix more bugs and ramp to a series of beta customers. Another week, make sure it's really polished. And then we would ramp to all customers. As part of ramping to all customers, we also work with marketing partners and product partners to let the customers know that this feature is coming out. So that's go-to-market. Sometimes the go-to-market is only the marketer saying, hey, customers, this feature is coming out. Like maybe send them an email or something. And then sometimes it's in-product go-to-market. So we would add like a tooltip or an announcement somewhere in the product saying, hey, this feature is new, it's coming out. That's also part of the development process, is figuring out how to show people, okay, hey, this exists now, go ahead and use it, and this is how you use it. Tagging is not a huge feature. It's an important feature, but to your point, it's something that is not too difficult to implement. But when you compare the feature in a big company to a sandbox environment, a lot of the difference is making sure it's scrutinized enough, make sure this is the quality that will suit the customers, and then making sure the go-to-market is efficient so that people know that it's there and they start using it.
That's incredible. You said something that caught my attention, which was back-end partners. As a front-endy person, I was like, who are these magicians? What do they do? Are they helping you basically think about how to scale the feature you're building? What are these back-end partners?
So the main way I end up working with my backend partner is when you call an API, you expect the data to be in a certain shape. So maybe you expect that you'll have certain values in an object, and you'll expect those values to be in certain formats. You expect it to be a number or a string or Boolean. One of the things that I do with my backend partner is just say, hey, I'm expecting if I call a post to this endpoint, this is what I'll send you. Is that what you're expecting? And that's the conversation that we have. There's sometimes when we need to make some adjustments because we don't realize that it's hard to distinguish people from companies. There's sometimes when we have to go back and forth a bit, but the main thing that we discuss with the backend partners is the contract between the front end and the backend. This is what I'm giving you. This is what I expect. And make sure that we're on the same page as far as like the contract goes.
This is incredible. This sounds like almost a pairing relationship. Are you all on the same team, or is this just what you're doing in order to get the feature out? Like you have to find this person.
Most of the time we're all on the same team. There was a time when our whole team was all UI engineers and the org was structured a little different, but right now we've got a team of half and half, front end, back end. And a lot of the features we work on are together. Although there's sometimes some work cross team and then we have different back end partners. It really depends on the feature and the scope of the feature. But generally, it's in your team or it's in a sister team.
That's amazing. So this leads me to one of the questions I had for you, which is often when I'm career coaching earlier stage non-traditional engineers, maybe if you go back in your memories or back to the days. Folks are always scared to commit to a specialization, or I see it as very common. I've diagnosed sometimes it's a fear that you're not going to get paid as much if you don't go after just straight software engineer as a title, or if you don't be a generalist, somehow being anything deviant from full stack is going to somehow affect your pay. Sometimes I'm able to diagnose that's the fear. But a lot of the conversations I have with folks is follow your curiosity, commit to the thing that you want to learn and go down in order to become known for something or to be valued and not overlooked. You are focused around a certain product area, but how do you think about specialization in your career in terms of like your role as a software engineer? Do you think of yourself as being super knowledgeable in a specific area?
Yes. And to your point, like when I was first way back in the day when I was a bootcamp student and looking at where should I go, what should I do as far as specialization goes, I had that same fear. I think one of my fears was, what if I choose something now, what if I miss opportunities later? If I say I'm a front-end engineer now, what if a back-end engineering opportunity comes and I'll not get that opportunity? I think that's a valid fear. I also think that if you're able to focus yourself early on and actually specialize, you're going to have an easier time both getting that first job and also ramping in your scope. If you're working in a big tech company, it's very rare to be a full stack engineer. I would say that unless you're going to a startup, the fear of if you're not a full stack engineer, then you won't get paid as much. I would probably argue that may not be true. Now I see my role. I'm definitely a pretty strictly UI or front end engineer. It took me getting to LinkedIn to actually choose that. I started as a back end engineer and then I got lured into front end and I stayed there ever since. But as far as how knowledgeable am I across the board, I have a lot to learn on the back end about how things work. I feel pretty comfortable with the front end. I feel like that's my wheelhouse. I'm solid there. I still have quite a bit to learn about the architecture of the back end and how things are working over there. That'll come with time, and I'm happy to be specializing in front end. I think it's a really interesting and it's a fun field to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like it's important to emphasize the idea that the back-end engineers that you're working with and the scale that you have to work in is very rare in the global sense. How many people know how to scale to the degree that you have to at LinkedIn around the world? You're really in a world-class environment is what I want to say. So
that's a good point. I think I don't see out of my bubble because I'm in a big tech company. All companies must be big tech companies. But to your point, I do agree that probably that's more the exception than the rule. So you're right.
Yeah. The way that I talk about it is you've become an Olympian, but you're still disappointed that you got like bronze or silver.
Oh, that's perfect.
You're in the Olympics. So also curious, just out of being naive, what does being a senior software engineer actually mean at LinkedIn? Does it imply that you at some point soon will have to choose between management and technical leadership? Because that's a thing I hear about often, is at a certain point you have to decide whether you're going to continue down a technical track or down a management track. Is that like relevant for you, or senior software engineer?
No, you're right on the money. There's a couple more levels after senior at LinkedIn. There's staff, there's senior staff, there's principal staff. There's really fancy ones after that. But once you reach staff, so one level above senior, then you are in that fork in the road that you described. You can choose to continue being an individual contributor, or you can choose to start looking into people management. Once I reached senior, my manager had a conversation with me. It was pretty soon after. He was like, okay, well, let's talk about getting you a staff. And then after staff, you need to think about which path you want to take. It's top of mind for sure. I do think that there's really interesting trade-offs when it comes to choosing a people management role versus an individual contributor or IC role. I'm still in that process of kind of thinking through, oh man, what does my future look like? Because as a senior, as a staff or senior staff or above individual contributor, the nature of your work changes because the scope gets bigger. And so I think then it becomes a matter of, where do you want your influence to lie? Do you want it to lie in technology primarily, or do you want it to lie in people and the team's roadmap primarily? It's definitely something that I have to think about. I have time to think about it, but it's certainly something to think about.
Interesting. So that's top of mind right now. Do you have any inklings or a sense of what goes through your mind when you think about that choice?
There's so many trade-offs. If I had to choose today, I would lean toward people management, because when I think about the work that is rewarding to me and how, when I can help people be successful, how that feels to me, I love that. That's something that is one of my favorite things. If I can support someone, help them be successful, help them with their career goals, that's super important. When I think about what managers do with product roadmaps and with their team's charter, carving a path for their team, that's exciting to me. When I think about technology roadmaps, I think it's really interesting, but I don't get that same buzz off of it. I guess the trade-off is there's that fear that if you move toward people management, are your technical skills going to get rusty? That's one of the things that I'm fighting with, is if I were to pursue that path, how would I maintain technical skills?
Sounds like a thing that it's good you have time. There's no rush.
Yeah, yeah. It's really good that I have time, because there's so many things to consider. I will say that I know people who have gone back and forth between manager and individual contributor. That's a thing. People do it. It's not if you choose one thing, then that's it. You can always say, I don't know, maybe I'll go back and do this instead, at least at LinkedIn.
Totally. So now today, when you're mentoring or bug squashing with junior engineers, what stands out to you and what do you recommend or advise when you're working with junior engineers now?
One of the biggest things is just developing that confidence in the work that you're doing, being able to look at a problem and list the pros and cons of the different solutions and being confident with the decision you make. I see struggles that I myself had in the past. So it might even be less technical and more just strategic. Teaching and mentoring problem solving and coming to an informed decision, coming to the table with an opinion. There's always the technical side of what's the best way to debug? What's the easiest way to solve your problem? There's another thing that I sometimes see in other people that I had struggled with and still sometimes struggle with, is knowing when to post the code for review versus iterating on it to make it perfect. In the past, and sometimes still now, I had a tendency to fine tooth comb, just make sure every I is dotted and T is crossed. I'm still very careful now, but you got to think about the time that you're spending versus several people taking a look at it. If there's something really wrong, hopefully a reviewer will also be a good second pair of eyes. If I go through the code like 15 times, is that really a good use of my time? Time management, managing perfectionism, bug identification, and debugging are all things that I would chat with when I mentor junior engineers.
It's awesome. It sounds like you have more context for what is a good use of your time versus a bad use of your time and when to call it.
I think so. I hope so. Although I'm still learning. It's definitely a process.
Yeah. You said strategic. You're able to discern better situations over time. Let's imagine we're pairing right now, or you're interviewing me and I'm a junior engineer and you're looking at my text editor and I'm programming in front of you. I'm having tons of imposter syndrome. I'll just be honest about the things I worry about right now, which is not having all of the keyboard shortcuts memorized, using Sublime instead of Vim, or VS Code because everyone's talking about the next thing and I can't keep up. We can reflect back on the dev bootcamp days where everyone's freaking out because they know Ruby and Rails so much, but everybody's using JavaScript and React. So then you feel worried about the specific technology that you're using. These are the things I'm thinking about as a junior engineer. What are you noticing? I'm curious if there's things you're seeing as a senior engineer that like us juniors are not really even considering.
When it comes to worrying about the technology and am I advancing fast enough? Am I moving with the technology fast enough? To be honest, I'm still using Sublime Text, so I think we're good. But I'm thinking about switching. A lot of senior and above staff, I think that is inconsequential. It's a very personal choice. You use what you're comfortable with, what you're familiar with. And if you want to try to branch out and learn something new, then by all means. But I don't think any reasonable person is going to judge you for using one text editor over another. I can definitely relate to just feeling, are the things that I'm doing enough? Do I know enough? One of the things that my manager told me over and over that I would probably tell to anyone who's more junior or who's in the early stages is just be patient with yourself. All it will take is what he called butt in seat time. Like basically you hands on the keyboard, doing what you do over and over. You're going to learn tips and tricks along the way. When I was being mentored, my mentor taught me like probably 15 keyboard shortcuts. And I remember maybe three of them, but eventually I pick up more. And you don't have to know it all right now. If you try to hold yourself to that standard, you're going to be super disappointed. But the more you practice and the more button seat time you get, the more comfortable you'll be with your skill set and you'll expand it naturally. It'll happen. Be patient. Don't expect yourself to be at 100% from day one or even day 100.
This is that anxiety that it makes people go in 20 different directions. I think it's a book called Minimalism. I used to give it to as many students as I could. It shows a line going in every direction and then the same amount of line going in one direction, and they're both right next to each other. I always think about that. But it's funny when you're going through it, like I'm going through it now, you just have this emotional sense of worry and anxiety, and that's what's driving you. I almost think being able to discern that you're having an emotional reaction to your skills or to your sense that you're not good enough, as opposed to like actually changing what technology you're using or forcing yourself to learn something new. There's wisdom there, essentially.
Yeah, I do think it can be considered an emotional reaction. Our former CEO, Jeff Weiner, always talks about being a spectator of your own thoughts. I think about that a lot because I can get stuck in my head. I'll go down a downward spiral of negative thoughts. Meditation has helped me with this, but when I'm able to sit back and listen to myself think, watch myself think, you realize that, to your point, this is an emotional reaction. I am doing great work. I have all this proof that I've made so much progress. Just sit back and realize that it put your thoughts in check. I do think that it's important to think about how far you come and compare that to the thoughts you're having right now. Based on those two things, are your thoughts valid or is this an emotional reaction? It's a tricky balance. It's hard.
It's so hard. So hard. I have a lot more empathy for it now. Now I've like finished a whole program and I'm just like, I thought I knew, but I had no idea.
That's awesome that you're continuing to learn and just pushing yourself. I think that's so inspiring.
Yeah, it's an adventure for sure. I came out of my camp during the pandemic. That's fun.
Oof. Yeah.
It's fun. It's really fun. Which brings us to pandemic life. How did your work change? What does work look like now?
So the environment, of course, changed completely. I was in the office, eating LinkedIn food, getting coffees with coworkers. And now I'm home and having to make my own lunch, which is more of a struggle than I ever thought it would be. And doing work in an isolated manner. The environment is completely different, but I've tried to keep the work itself mostly the same. A lot of people really struggle with isolation. When you are in a work environment that's highly social, and that suddenly becomes a work environment where it's just you and your computer screen and sometimes people on Zoom, it makes it hard to keep the same momentum and the same attitude. I have tried things like just hanging out with coworkers on Zoom and not necessarily talking about work, and getting outside for walks instead of eating lunch in front of the screen. It's definitely been an adjustment. I think we're all just doing the best we can and still doing our best work. And hopefully, eventually, we'll be back in person. We'll see, I guess. I don't know really what the future of remote work is, but I definitely could use some more face-to-face time with people. So I won't complain if I have to go back to the office.
Absolutely. I felt you on so many levels. Are you a fan of Ali Wong?
Yeah.
when you said that you missed the lunches at work, I immediately had a flash to that bit where she's, I made his lunch every day. I did that to make him dependent on me. Like, now the employees are dependent on the cafeteria food. It's very hard to open the fridge every day and see ingredients instead of meals. That's a hard reality. Food prep has become a different level. I feel like I have a much more profound appreciation for the entire supply chain of food in general.
Yes.
Because we're so reliant on ourselves now to feed ourselves.
It's such a fatiguing process. It's I should probably get into intermittent fasting just so that I have to think about less meals. It's so hard to think about what am I going to eat multiple times a day.
Totally. I've found it's helpful to focus on the smallest things these days in order to find joy and to get through. You touched on sitting down to lunch as being one of the habits, like getting away from a screen. But curious if there are any other habits or routines you've been doing during quarantine that have brought you happiness or peace?
Yes, two things. The first, my therapist told me about this, and it's called the 5-minute journal. The premise is you sit down in the morning for 5 minutes and you answer the following questions. Today I am grateful for, and you write 3 things. What would make today great? So you prioritize what you want to get done. And people I am grateful for. So you write those down. And then in the evening, you write down 3 of these categories. Great things that have happened today. What would make today better? Obstacles I learned from today. And then goals for tomorrow. I found that that practice of 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes in the evening has been really beneficial to start and end my day, to focus on gratitude, to focus on prioritization, and to think about ways where I could learn from anything that went wrong. That has honestly changed my life. Like, I'm going to write an article about it because I keep telling people about it. And then the second thing is meditation. And for me, it's just 5 minutes via an app in the morning to get my head in a good space before I start work. And sometimes it's in the evening when I'm going to sleep. But meditation, I was always not interested in the idea because it seems a little far out there for me. But work had a challenge where they promised a free hoodie if we meditated for 30 days. And I can't pass up free hoodies. And so I tried it and I just fell in love. So I'm still doing that.
That's amazing. Things that get people to change their habits.
Exactly.
It sounds like a good way to develop emotional intelligence at work too. Have you picked up any new hobbies or interests during quarantine?
Yeah. So I was cycling a bit before, road biking. When quarantine started, I picked that up 100 notches and just started cycling a ton. The nice thing about cycling in the Bay is the bike infrastructure is pretty good. There's a lot of really beautiful routes. It can be socially, or I guess physically, distant. I don't really like the term social distance because it seems so like antisocial, but it can be done in a safe manner. It's outside and gets you your heart going. It's meditative. So I'm super fan of cycling now, even though I look really dorky in my clothes.
That's awesome. Do you have one of those? I've seen some really aerodynamic helmets. The outfits in cycling, I would say cycling is up there. Gymnastics is up there. Figure skating. Cycling has some great outfits. Do you have one of those? One of those colorful ones?
Mine are a little bit boring, to be honest, but I do have some good LinkedIn jerseys, which I'm proud of. I don't have an aerodynamic helmet. I'm not quite at that level yet, but maybe one day. We'll see.
What is your favorite technology today? I'm saying technology to be broad. I don't want to be like, what's your favorite language? Or what's your favorite framework? What is your go-to technology that you love right now?
That's a good question. I've been so stuck in JavaScript and Ember.js, which is JavaScript framework world, for so long. I think that Ember is doing some really interesting things with their new Octane release, which is basically the new version of Ember. I'm really interested to see where that goes, but I should look into more frameworks and just see what's out there. It's very easy to get buried in work and then just not look around you and see what the rest of the technology world has to offer. I will say, and it's a bit of a tangent, I don't know if it falls under technology, but I started listening a little bit to Clubhouse, and I think the idea of that platform is very interesting. It's interesting the way they built it because they're using a service for their audio. So the audio doesn't live in-house from what I understand, or the audio capabilities don't live in-house. I think that's interesting the way they built it so fast, leveraging a different service.
I've had a tough time getting on Clubhouse, but I'm trying again more. It gives me a lot of FOMO and I feel like I can't manage my schedule as effectively with it. But they've gotten a little bit better, it seems like, over time.
Yeah. I join mostly when I know somebody is having a room that I'm interested in. I don't usually go in and browse and look for something. It's more of just, oh, I know this person from my work is speaking about product and I want to hear what they have to say.
If you could go safely anywhere in the world right now, where would you go?
Oh, just everywhere. Oh my goodness. Let's see, but I need to choose one place. I'd probably go back to Japan, to be honest. The experiences that I've had there so far have been so unique and interesting and vibrant and memorable. I haven't been to Tokyo yet. And so I would just love to experience the rest of Japan.
That's awesome. I love Japanese culture as well.
Yeah.
It's a cool spot.
Where would you go?
Being quarantined abroad, there's a part of me that's like, I would go home. Because even if I do go back to the United States, there is this sense that I can't really see my parents because I'd be potentially endangering them. So there is that idea that I would go home. The ideal place in the world, in my opinion, no, we debate this a lot in my house. We love Bali and surfing, beaches. I love the rice fields. I love the really fantastic yoga there. I really love Hindu culture also. The idea that there's many gods and it's a lot of embracing of chaos. I really love Bali. Often comes up, but it's just so far away and so isolated. I got a pandemic puppy and I think she actually really enjoyed the longer flight that she had to go on because she got to snuggle me the whole time. So it was like her ideal situation, but I feel bad traveling so far with a dog. What parting words do you have for our crew of non-traditional folks? What inspirational things would you like to close with?
I think the thing that just comes to my mind over and over, and I mentioned this a bit ago, but I'll just mention it again because it's so important to me. Be patient with yourself. This process, even though the boot camp process can be crazy and rapid, the process of growing as an engineer and growing into an engineering role is long. Sometimes it's hard, and a lot of times it's extremely rewarding, but you need to grant yourself that time to be patient and put in the work, but also just let it happen. Be open to opportunities, be open to learning. Keep a growth mindset, but just overall be patient. And you'll look back on the past 4 years like I am right now and think, damn, I've done a lot. I've come a long way, and be proud.
It's amazing. I can't believe it's been 4 years. It's so wild.
I can't believe it either. It's a marathon. People say it's a marathon, not a sprint, but marathons are super hard too. It's still going to be hard. It's just going to last a little longer.
That's amazing. The bugs that you have today, people, will not be the bugs that you have tomorrow. That's what we have to focus on.
Yes. Yes. And you are not your code. So even if you create bugs, you're still a worthwhile human.
Ooh, I love that. That's important. And on that one for sure.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Apprenticeship.io podcast. You can learn more about apprenticeships and find us online at www.apprenticeship.io. Don't forget to follow us on Spotify and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Want to get a shout out on the podcast or support our work? Become a patron at www.patreon.com/apprenticeship.io. Until next time, we're rooting for you.